We apologize for taking so long. Already ahead. So I see that you are going to be talking to Mrs. M.K. Matau, and who is the Deputy Director General of the National Department of Health. I don't know whether there's someone else. You can introduce yourself.
Thank you very much, and good morning. I'd just like to confirm that you did receive the text that we sent earlier 2 days ago. The presentation that will be done by Dr. Amos is really based on that text, and the presentation just highlights some of the most important things. Maybe something to say is that we did receive this invitation a little bit late, because I think it got sent directly to the minister's office, but and nevertheless, we were able to put together this. There is a lot, I have to start by saying there's a lot more that we could have put in the presentation, but we didn't think it would add much value. We just took a few of the things that we thought mattered the most. Going directly to the subject of progress in promoting women's and reproductive, women's health and reproductive rights, with a special focus to HIV and AIDS. I think that just that excuse me, I don't know if it's my phone that's going. I'm sorry. Sorry about that. What is significant here is that that caveat that says a special focus of HIV and AIDS, which then stretches then from just maternal and child to maternal health issues and also to HIV and AIDS issues. So as we do the presentation, you will notice a lot of HIV and AIDS. So please, it mustn't be misinterpreted that we did a concentration of HIV and AIDS when we should have done maternal and child, maternal health, and the rights and the reproductive rights of women, and maternal health in general. It would help, I think, in future to do two separate presentations and then a combined presentation, because then it really does show the extent to which maternal health in itself has progressed, as opposed to issues around rights and HIV and AIDS, but issues on maternal health, which tends to be overlooked each time the area of HIV and AIDS is introduced. Then we overlook some of the very important things which have always been important, even before the era of HIV and AIDS, and that's what you would like to show progress in. Yes. As I said, Dr. Amos will do the presentation, but just to preface it by saying that in the last 14 years, we have concentrated a lot on developing policy frameworks and legislation that ensures the rights of women for their reproductive health and their health as just women. And we've gone a long way in doing programs, implementing programs put those rights in reality, in practical lives, for women. Much of what we do has a lot to do with what is happening internationally. We are signatory to a lot of conventions that seek to protect women, their health, and their reproductive rights. And you will see during the presentation that the ground is covered in terms of these. And I must say that we've been reviewing what has happened in a lot of countries, particularly developing countries. And with a bit of pride, we have to say South Africa has advanced a lot, even just in the recognition of what needs to be done in terms of the policies, drawing up the policies, and trying to draw up programs that do this. There are a lot of countries who, ever since a lot of these conventions have been pronounced, which have not even ratified the convention. So the fact that we ratified, we've got policies, we've got programs, and we're actually doing work in that area, says a lot about the rate of progress that has been made. The second thing that one would like to highlight in terms of these is that as part of promoting women's health and women's reproductive rights, South Africa is one of the few countries that has recognized the importance of the involvement of males. Maybe to do with our social anthropological background, where we have a highly patriarchal society, and that has accounted to a large extent to the failures in women's health, where we've tried as women to improve these without involving or educating the men. I'm not aware of any country that has specific programs that address men specifically. And it's one area also that in the beginning had seemed to be impossible. But we've successfully now got maybe not brilliant in terms of the achievements, but recognizable programs of male involvement in women's health. Madam Chair, having said that, then I would like to hand over to Dr. Amos to do the presentation. And again, I would like to emphasize that there are two areas, distinct areas: women's health and women's reproductive rights, and women's health in the context of HIV and AIDS. And I hope we'll be able to actually see that combined area of focus for this presentation. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Mazal. Just before the Chief Director comes in, I would like the members of the committee to introduce themselves. These are the members that we have been looking for, the members that are very consistent, the ones that I was to tell you that have been done, have been put as alternates. It's not their fault. It's the fault of the Chief Whip's office. So we had to go and get them. Can you introduce yourself? You may continue. We just had a presentation. Actually, it was just a comment from Mrs. Mazao, and also an explanation of what they are coming to present, and what they have done in South Africa, actually, as a department, compared to other countries, and the protocols that have been ratified by South Africa, the importance of the international instruments that they have followed as the department. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, members of the committee, my colleague. I'd also like to thank Mrs. Masau for brilliantly contextualizing the subject. of discussion for today by giving the brief background. Our presentation outline is as follows. We have an introduction. We obviously are looking at the legislative and policy framework, both global and local, that assist in to provide an enabling environment within which we progress with our program. We have looked at the program implementation status, and obviously in line with the discussion or the topic of today, which is briefing on progress made in promoting women's reproductive health and rights, with a special focus on HIV and AIDS. Now, the programs are outlined, as you can see, contraception and family planning, choice on the termination of pregnancy, gender-based violence, male involvement, prenatal and postnatal care, youth-friendly services, and the conclusion. I thought it is important, much as Ms. Matau has given us a brief framework, but to try and provide a definition of what sexual and reproductive health and rights means, so that we are all on the same page. In our presentation here, we have given the definition as a reproductive health and rights that includes the rights of couples and individuals to make free and informed choices about their reproductive lives. Their rights include rights of all individuals to make free and informed decisions on all matters relating to their sexuality. Having said that, I think I like the definition which has been an amendment of the WHO definition of sexual and reproductive health, as has been aptly defined in the National Strategic Plan for the Implementation of the Choice on Termination of Pregnancy, Act 92 of 1976, and this reads as follows. Sexual and reproductive health and rights include the rights of couples and individuals to make free and informed choices about their reproductive lives, including their number, timing, spacing of their children, so as to attain the highest standard of sexual and reproductive health. And the sexual rights include the rights of all individuals to make free and informed decisions on all matters relating to their sexuality, to be free of discrimination, coercion, or violence in their sexual lives and decisions, and to expect and demand quality, full consent, mutual respect, and shared responsibility in sexual relationships. The enabling legislative framework and policy framework is as follows. The global treaties and commitments, as has been referred to by Mrs. Matau, that South Africa ratified and is signatory to the elimination of all forms of discrimination against women, the CEDAW 1995 document, the Beijing Platform of Action 1996, the Millennium Development Goals of 2000, four of which relate directly to the subject of discussion today, three which refer to gender, four is under 5 mortality rate, 5 is reduction of maternal mortality rate, and 6, of course, focuses on HIV, AIDS, TB, and malaria. South Africa, together with other African ministers, recommitted to the implementation of the International Conference of Population and Development, ICDP, Cairo 1994, and would recall that it is at this meeting here where focus was now being shifted, or a realization was there that maternal and child health are very high indices of national development, and therefore sexual and reproductive health was highlighted as a result of that. And again, South Africa, we adopted sexual and reproductive health, the policy framework, at the second ordinary session of the Conference of African Ministers of Health came to in Gaborone, Botswana in 2005. Now, subsequent to that, the ministers of health, the AU ministers of health, held a special conference on sexual and reproductive health in September of 2006 in Maputo, the aim of which was to refocus on sexual and reproductive health. And also the theme of that particular conference was operationalization of the sexual and reproductive health a policy framework that was agreed upon at the other previous conferences referred to. Now, with the local commitments, obviously, South Africa, as Mrs. Matau has indicated, has been very progressive. You know, we've got very progressive legislation. The choice of termination on pregnancy, Act of 1966, and of course the South Africa, the constitution of the country that we know emphasizes discrimination against all forms of violence, but however, it highlights specifically issues that relate to women's sexuality, you know, gender, violence, and their sexual and reproductive health rights, of course. And of course, again, our local policies and commitments. We know that we do have, presently, we have been implementing the choice of termination of pregnancy. However, the focus was on the manual vacuum extraction, that is surgical termination of pregnancy. We are now moving, or we have a draft of policy documents on the medical termination of pregnancy. We also have policy on the conscientious objection to CTOP. Like when we are looking at a human right, we don't necessarily focus on the one group to the disadvantage of the other. We are aware that our nursing professionals also feel, based on their religious beliefs and morals, that this is not an issue. We have made room for that. We do not stop their objection, but we are saying, however, in providing them with their rights, that should not then disadvantage the rights of individuals who seek the termination of pregnancy for whatever reason, because who are we to judge? We also have a drafted policy on fertility options, including for the HIV and AIDS infected. We are still busy on this, doing research and also even interviews with people with HIV and AIDS infected, traditional healers and everybody else, where work is in process. We also have a policy on sexual assault care. These are available. But again, we have, although sexual assault management is happening in 100% of our hospitals, we are presently updating sexual assault care training manual so that we improve the skills of those who are providing, you know, the service. We've gone past the pilot staging. What we need to do again is for the dissemination of the documents so that we can have access. In addition to that, we are also updating our cervical cancer screening policy document. This is being updated with so as to include, you know, cervical cancer screening on HIV and AIDS infected patients. As I'm doing this, I'm trying to show the link between the sexual reproductive health and HIV and AIDS, of course, with particular focus or emphasis on the rights of everybody. Again, even our family planning training manual and policy, these are also being reviewed. So they're being updated to include everything else to improve on what we've been doing in the past. We do have a comprehensive sexual and reproductive health strategy in draft form. And incidentally, this Maputo conference that they've made reference to made ministers of religion to commit to having this strategy completed by 2008. And we are hopeful that this will be completed during this year. And the local policies and commitments, we do have the National Strategic Plan, the NSP 2007 to 2010. And And obviously, I'm sure we are aware of the priorities of the strategy here, and it's got four priorities, one being prevention, prevention being primary prevention, secondary prevention, and tertiary prevention. The CCMT, with comprehensive care management and treatment, and then the third thing is the research priority, and I'm happy that we've got researchers here. They probably are aware on, you know, issues that need to be looked into. And the fourth priority, it is human rights and access to justice. That is the fourth pillar of our national specific plan on HIV and AIDS. And then, of course, we presently have our new PMTCT guidelines, which have the implementation of which we have just started this year. I think as we speak now, almost all provinces are now conducting or implementing the new policy guidelines, and also have begun to put our patients on the dual therapy, both mothers and as well as the children. And most importantly about these new guidelines, we have not refrained from patient rights, because despite all the things, we still insist as the department that people have to volunteer, people have to agree into taking the test, although we would have loved everybody to take the test so that they know their status. However, nobody is being coerced into taking the test, although we try to promote that. And obviously, again, the aim here is to improve the quality and also access to the service. And maybe let's look at the program status and implementation. When we look at the contraception and family planning services, objective 2.5 of the National Strategic Plan refers to the integration of sexual reproductive health services and HIV and AIDS. And what has happened is that how our family planning, contraception and family planning services are being integrated with HIV and AIDS, it is not only a provision of condoms, like dual protection. However, we are also trying to incorporate VCT into family planning services. Obviously, again, this is voluntary. Presently, 65% contraception coverage. We have 65% contraception coverage in South Africa, where 13.357 women have undergone, I beg your pardon, not hysterectomy, but sterilization, and 4.623 men have undergone vasectomy. And now we come to the choice on the termination of pregnancy. A very sensitive issue, however, that for you know, the belief and also respect for human rights, we felt this has to be provided. We currently provide the choice on termination of pregnancy in 70% of hospitals and 27% of primary health care facilities. And this program here caters for all women, including those that are HIV infected, as well as those with disabilities. All our programs are being accessed to everybody that is deserving or that needs or requires or demands. As you will recall that in my definition of the right is that there has to be demand and quality from our the population. Yes, I have made mention of a little concern here that there appears to be some decline in contraception use and an increase in a demand for termination of pregnancy. And yet the choice on termination of pregnancy was not a replacement of contraception or family planning. We are very vigilant, we are looking closely into that there are certain circumstances within which we feel people have to make an informed consideration. However, we cannot say that now has to be used as a form of family planning, even if it is on demand. Looking at the gender-based violence, I'm sure you all recall that initially we had the so-called 16 days of activism against violence against women and children. However, as Mrs. Matau indicated, that South Africa is still such a patriarchal society, which, you know, male dominance and women playing a subservient role in some instances. We have increased through the leadership of the deputy president to extend this period to be a daily observation. That is 365 days a year for prevention of the gender-based violence. And again, I think it's important for us to say that we do have the so-called the Tutuzela centers or places of safety for women. We've got about 10 of those things throughout the country, and these are situated or located within the hospitals so that our patient, when the patients get to this facility here, they receive a comprehensive and holistic approach to whatever problems that they have. Even assistance in terms of, you know, going into court and how to present your case and those kinds of things. Well, you'll realize that sometimes when women have been so violated, it becomes even so difficult to even point at the perpetrator. And again, here, a concern of this preponderance of violence against women. I'm not saying men are not necessarily violated. And this is where perhaps in my next slide, I'm going to make reference to men involvement in sexual and reproductive health and rights. Like Mrs. Matau said, you know, she knows perhaps of very few countries that have really brought this to practice or fruition. You know, we also in South Africa do not have any specific coverage or a database of all the groups of males who are involved in sexual and reproductive health. But even on a small scale, in other instances, when our patients come for antenatal care clinic or family planning clinic, or STI in particular, we always say, can you give this to your partner, you know, so that these can come. And we do have, I must say, quite a number of male activists throughout the country. And this, you know, came to light when sometime last year, when we organized a three-day workshop on men groups, we had what I saw to be a very good response, in the sense that the number of men who attended this workshop were about 250, and they came from all over the country. Every province had representatives, and it also had a traditional healers and leaders. And you could see in the mood of the conference here that these are the people who are really taking their stand as fathers in terms of protecting their rights and of course being sympathetic to the violence against women. The objectives of this male involvement were to develop an understanding of men's sexual and reproductive health and their experiences. And it was interesting that we, at this conference here, we had two male speakers, one a urologist, another an obstetrician. And it was very clear that the men themselves hardly understand their own sexuality. And what it is that we can expect of them understand the sexuality of their partner. And these were the things that came, you know, to the fore. And also the hunger that males have in terms of understanding, you know, this is topic of, you know, sexuality that we always try to put it aside, and when it is exactly the cause of all the mayhem that we see out there. And of course, another objective was to identify the ways in which men can support their partners' participation in maternal and child health, sexual reproductive, especially HIV and AIDS. Somebody always said, sometimes, although we've got the women who are bearing the burden of the HIV and AIDS, however, our male partners are the vectors, you know, like the mosquito vectors, we know where to go to. But here, our male folk has been left behind. Our programs have been biased towards, you know, women at the almost exclusion of men, and we have identified that there is a need here. And, of course, another objective was to increase male skills, their knowledge and motivation that is related to sexual and reproductive health. And out of this seminar here, we had a task group that came together that included these males who wanted to be part of the strategy of male involvement in sexual and reproductive health. And the progress needs to date is that there is a desk review of male involvement in sexual reproduction is completed, and this is going to be discussed at a meeting just in the next few days, that is in June. The programs are dealing with perinatal and postnatal care. When we look at the antenatal care, we realize that this is an entry point for HIV/AIDS infected, you know, and we are providing the comprehensive care, or it's an opportunity again for women to be able to access the comprehensive care management and support programs that includes counseling and feeding choices, as we are aware that even if we come for antenatal care, we need to get their consent in terms of testing. However, whether they've consented to testing or not, we feel it is our mandate that we provide them with information and their choices, of course, in terms of their babies. For instance, for those who are HIV infected, they do have a choice of exclusive breastfeeding or formula feeding, and the government does provide free formula to those HIV infected women who opt for exclusive formula feeding. Testing is an integral part of PMTCT, as well as family planning, as has been referred to. And this, again, antenatal care is an opportunity of women of unknown status to undergo voluntary counseling. I decided, like Mrs. Matau at some stage in her introduction, made reference to the fact that sometimes, you know, it's like the focus has been so much on HIV and AIDS, and to almost, you know, a forgotten other areas like maternal and child mortality rate, the MDG5 that I said South Africa was signatory to. That, you know, we had had non-pregnancy related infections, if we're aware of the report on the confidential inquiry into maternal death, or the so-called CD mothers report, that we have maternal death, 35%. That are predominant, 37% that are predominantly as a result of HIV and AIDS. And now this makes it logical to integrate this maternal child health and HIV and AIDS. Other causes of maternal death are hypertension, obstetric hemorrhage, and of course the hemorrhage will even be worse in an HIV and AIDS infected patient. So you need to be very, very vigilant. Pregnancy-related sepsis, pre-existing maternal conditions, and again, the concern here is that maternal deaths are attributable to avoidable factors, missed opportunities, and sometimes substandard care. We there's again a little concern in the sense that we do have a very high coverage of antenatal care attendance at 92% according to the District Information System of 2003, and of course an 84% of delivery at facilities through skilled death attendance. But it would appear that we still have missed opportunities to improve maternal health. And of course, the strategy to address maternal death, the department is implementing the recommendations from the National Committee on Contracts Inquiry into Maternal Death to try and reduce this death. And of course, the basic antenatal care is a strategy that is focusing, that is assisting in focused antenatal care for quality assurance so as to improve pregnancy outcomes. PMTCT, as we all know, that it's the primary prevention of HIV and AIDS, and prevention of unintended pregnancies through family planning, because this PMTCT obviously is provided to our patients at an antenatal care clinic. We don't have a separate antenatal care clinic from PMTCT, it is one thing. And this is obviously to prevent viral transmission from mother to child, and also to provide a comprehensive care management and treatment for affected women and their families. Because in the event where we find that during the testing, and we do the CD4 count, and we find it to be below 200, but although we've increased the number to 250 now, of the CD4 count, our women then get referred for this comprehensive care, or what people commonly refer to as HART. what we do during intrapartum care. Of course, we take care of all our women, HIV infected and or not infected. However, extra precautionary measures here are taken for those who are HIV infected, so that we know that we need to avoid unnecessary vaginal examination. We've got to avoid any rupture of membranes, unnecessary episiotomies, forceps deliveries, vaginal extractions, excessive suction of the newborn, and obviously we need to know to be able to resuscitate our newborn. Postpartum care again here. We know that immediate postpartum care is extremely important. Neonatal death, that contributes about 40% of our under 5 mortality rate. This needs attention. And most important interventions here are breastfeeding within the first hour of birth. And there is scientific evidence to say that this practice here improves the life of mothers and children. It also promotes bonding between mother and child, provides warmth to the baby for those mothers who have chosen to breastfeed. And our kangaroo mother care, which empowers the mothers of low birth weight babies to actively participate in the care of their unborn. This kangaroo mother care, we know, provides, as I say, an opportunity also for bonding. It promotes or improves breastfeeding. It reduces the length of stay in our hospital. And it minimizes the infections because there is just a sole person with the mother taking care of her child. And we also have our program on youth and friendly services, a very critical area there. We are providing our young people with life skills, education that will also include negotiation skills, and thereby uplifting their right to informed decision making. The benefits of our youth friendly services are understanding the value of good health seeking behavior, encouraging peers to use health services appropriately, that is their peer-to-peer education, respect the rights and responsibilities of young people, to facilitate the interaction between adults and the young people, to also encourage youth to be full participants of their sexual and reproductive health. In conclusion, Chairperson, I'd like to say the Constitution of South Africa lays the foundation for a right-based approach in programming. Obviously, once we start talking about this human rights, we know that we've got issues, ethical issues that are implicated here. Being non-judgmental, respecting the opinions and feelings of our patients, and treating our people with dignity. And in addition to that, lastly, the principles guiding HIV testing care and support include imperatives of the Constitution, our particular principles, and those guiding the implementation of the National Strategic Plan 2007 to 2011. I thank you.
Thank you, Chief Erica.
I don't know whether someone else is going to give us a presentation, but for now, I think we'll ask the members whether they want to intervene in the presentation that has been made. Is there anyone who wants to intervene? Marcus, do you want to intervene? Or we should get the other presentation? Is there any other presentation?
No.
Okay.
All right.
Since there is no one as yet who wants to intervene, I want to
thank you for your presentation. Very elaborate. And I think we have covered most of the parts that we wanted to know. Now that we're having a budget process, what I would like to know is that the budget that you have in the department, does it sufficiently cover for all these programs that you're talking about? The other thing I would like to know is that this operationalization of sexual and reproductive health and rights continental policy framework. You know, we have been having discussions as the National Gender Machinery with many forums, of which what we have discovered is that not much has been discussed about reproductive health, as you also said in your first comment. And I would like to ask whether the people who are gender-focused persons are fully utilized maybe to disseminate the information in your department. The policy on the sexual and reproductive health and rights, the policy that you are talking about, policy on sexual assault that is in place, how long do you think you will be able to roll out the document? This male involvement that we are talking about is very important. And I think that is what we needed, actually. I don't know how far are people informed about this, because it is quite clear that HIV and AIDS has got a woman's face. And ever since this high prevalence of the HIV and AIDS, our male counterparts seem not to be educated enough about this. They are in denial. And this is very dangerous, because they move from one woman to another, and some of them are very healthy, and it's very difficult for one to detect whether they are sick. And it's very good that to identify ways in which men can support their partners. I think that's a very good stance. So far, I'll end up here. Maybe we can discuss.
Okay.
I think Uma Mangela wants to come in also.
That's maybe a funny question on page 5. Contraception and family planning services. The last bullet that says 13,000 blah 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 women and men had undergone hysterectomy. Are they forced to do hysterectomy, or they are going there voluntarily? I'm asking this because I'm an African woman, a rural African woman. I'm sure you know that if you are rural and you go for hysterectomy, you are not a woman anymore. That's why I wanted to know, is it, do they do it voluntarily, or they are forced by sickness maybe to do it? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Maybe I should start with the last question, because it's actually the shortest. The shortest answer. In fact, that was a time when it wasn't meant to be hysterectomy, it was meant to be sterilization. But even if I were to address the hysterectomy issue, what we are finding, and which is generally, I think it's logical for me, it sounds logical, is that it's not so, women don't do hysterectomy so much as a family planning issue. Usually when they do a hysterectomy, it has some kind of a link with their own health, for one reason or another. Very, very few women would do a hysterectomy because
we feel I've had enough children, I don't need any more. I don't want the risk of cancer and all and do that. But generally, hysterectomy is not a popular, it's not much a much used mechanism for family planning. Because, simply because we've got lots of alternatives. So they don't really do hysterectomy. They would do a hysterectomy if there was a set of cancer, if there was, you know, all sorts of things starting to show, to beginning to show. But in this particular context, we are talking about sterilization.
Yeah, why are there, Mrs. Bata? I just want to know, how have you had any forum whereby you have interacted with the traditional leaders on some of these things, just to make a rider on what you know?
Yes, certainly. I mean, those are our biggest partners. For our cancer program, cancer screening program, and usually it's cervical cancer we are talking about. We have these forums and rallies and campaigns and what, and the people who are involved, one of the most well-represented sector of the general population would be traditional healers, because we want to have a common understanding of what this is, and what are the options to prevent it, and what are the options to deal with it if it occurs, cancers within the cervical cancer. So there are actually, yes ma'am, traditional healers involved. And even within the context of our HIV and AIDS programs, as you know, we have a section within the unit that's headed by traditional healers, and who then liaise, have a network who liaise with other traditional healers to carry forward or inform or ask for their participation and support of the programs that are done by the Department of Health. There is, in fact, I would even venture to say of all the different sectors of society, traditional healers seem to be the ones we are working a lot with, much more with. I mean, as opposed to, say, for instance, religious people, as opposed to, academia, as opposed to. So there is a significant amount of interaction with traditional healers in various areas, HIV and AIDS, reproductive health, cancer, because those are very, very common. There's a common factor, a woman, in all those.
Are we making strides in reaching the media? Because those are the most resistant, that is the most resistant group, especially on discrimination,
Yes, for the very reason, Madam Chair, that they are resistant, and we've been very cautious about how we deal with religious leaders. And in that area, the minister specifically deals with religious leaders, because we think if she can make an inroad to the top, there's a committee of theirs, a forum, where the heads, Bishop, Archbishop Napier, Archbishop Njongunkulu, now which is Makoro, of course, you know, there is that a forum, Tukamji and the others, the Jewish Council and all that. But that forum is actually the official member of that forum is a minister. We go there to supply information, to do presentations and all. And I have to say we are very cautious, because we feel that if we get it wrong at that level, there is no way we'll penetrate the general level. And you will have noticed, I'm sure, that once a year, the same forum meets with the president as well. And that's also to try to break through into the religious sector, through the top, the captains of the sector, the sectors. So we are involved, but not so much at our level. At our level, we get involved on an individual basis. Like I give a talk at my church on, you know, I'm invited to, and other people, that kind of thing. But the formal involvement and interaction happens at the ministerial level with the heads of the different denominations. Okay. If I were to start to answer, some of the details of my answers will be provided by Dr. Amos. The issue of the budget. Obviously, what we have presented now is progress, which means we have had a budget to cover that. But I will hasten to say, in many instances, the budget is not enough, or that because of the links in this particular area, in terms of the administration, in terms of the organogram, the HIV and AIDS cluster is a different cluster from the maternal and child health organogram, this cluster. So sometimes there is a conflict of interest in terms of where to spend. There are those areas where you cannot say this is an MCH problem or this is an HIV and AIDS problem, and they need to complement each other. Fortunately, though, as we are all aware, or at least we should admit, AIDS has attracted a lot of finance, not only internally but even externally. So while there could be a shortage in terms of the budget for some of the programs in MCWH, in maternal and child health, we try as much as possible to access resources of common ground from the HIV and AIDS cluster. So yes, the budget generally adequate many that times when it's inadequate, but it has not been a major major issue because of the other little money box we have on the HIV and AIDS. We would obviously like to, when Dr. Amos was presenting, she was saying of some of the things that we will do. And we'd all obviously like to have much more budget to be able to do those things. But obviously, the budget that's allocated has to benefit everybody, every one of us in the department. So it's not always that we get exactly what we want. But I repeat that it has not been a major crisis because of the ability of the department to hire funds sometimes or to have a joint program that can be that can be financed from the other sector. It is, of the two, I would say yes, maternal and child health is under-resourced as compared to the HIV and AIDS program. The gender focal point, the use of the gender focal point in the department. I must say that I think here is a structural thing within government and not just the department. That gender focal points are more an extension of the gender commission and are doing line function work in relation. It's almost like a dual, you know, dual lawyers, where there's work that is specific to the Department of Health, but then directed by the program of the gender focal, the gender commission. Yes, the gender commission. I can see the logic why it has to be that way, but it does have its own disadvantages, because according to the constitution, anything that has to do with gender actually has to be determined at the commission level. Now, our program cannot be determined at the commission level because it really is more a health program. So while the gender focal point is fully utilized, she also has the dual obligation of working with the Gender Commission. It's a rather, I don't think she can be more used than she is now because of the structure, the way the structure is. Issues like sexual assault program, for instance, was driven from the gender focal point, which is fine, no problem with that. But it also is an issue of human rights and maternal health and health rights and all this. So structurally in government, my personal opinion is that something needs to be done there that releases the gender focal point more to the departments rather than to the commission. But they are fully utilized. They are fully utilized. I'm just saying that this dual allegiance and dual reporting could be a problem for them. I'm not sure. But in our particular case, the focal point has had quite a few successful programs. And, an implementation of the CEDAW requirements, a lot of those CEDAW requirements, this elimination of discrimination, all forms of discrimination against women, is being driven by the gender focal point. But it is a program level that the clusters then take over and do the work. I hope, Madam Chair, you're asking the question because you've noticed that sort of thing needs a bit of improvement somehow. I can't suggest, I'm not sure how.
Actually, just to it's a very problematic issue. That's the reason why we are asking. I think at the mouthpiece of this committee, because of...
How the gender focal points have been perceived differently in departments. For the mere fact that they are not decision makers, so they are expected to do a different roles, but some of these roles are quite different from the expectations we have from the national gender framework. I think we have to really raise this, and their accountabilities, they should be accounting to the Office of the Status of Women, by the way. Yes. And we just spoke to the Status of Women last week, and they also agreed that in their set plan that they presented to us, this is an area whereby they haven't professionalized the whole thing. It's quite difficult because we are not really addressing what is supposed to be done by the gender focal person. I think if you're talking about this maternal reproductive health as a whole, the person who should be more concerned, who should be dealing with that, is a gender focal person, should be more involved in that. I don't know how do they expect to do it in health, but that is how we understand it as the whole national gender machinery, which comprises of the CGE, the Commission on Gender Equality, the Office of the Status of Women, and ourselves as the GMC. Nevertheless, I don't think maybe we can really put this on your shoulders because I think the response must come from elsewhere, and we just want to know in all these departments how is this addressed. I think the explanation you have given us, of course, has helped us a lot so that we know where the area, where the problems are lying. Okay.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I must say that we have found our own gender now. I don't know whether it's the individual or it's generally very useful in terms of assessing whether gender, the concept of gender has been mainstreamed into the program. That has been the best value that I have found, because a lot of us don't quite understand what this gender story is about. And what she has done is gone through the departmental program.
It might be a year.
Yeah.
That's why we call him a
person. In our case, fortunately, it's a she. Yeah. So she does understand. She has a bit more understanding than a he would have about issues that affect that agenda-based. We found that in terms of upping, the knowledge and understanding about gender issues, she has been very useful. My concern would be whether she would actually be able to do the health part of it, which is slightly different now. I still feel that the health part of the issues, the actual physiology health issues, should be done by the health. Now, the actual gender awareness and the gender injection into the thing must be done by this person who specializes in the understanding the concept of gender. But again, like I said, this dual reporting and dual loyalty is a bit of a problem, I think, for them more than for us. So that's why I was saying maybe that's where government should look at what needs to be done.
I think once Naomi answered all the questions, I've got a few questions of my own that I'd like to ask after she's answered the other
questions. Okay. The next question was a question about the sexual assault. There was a question about that.
How long have you been detained for this sexual assault?
This policy was finished, completed in about 2-3 years ago or something like that. That's why I was mentioning that in actual fact, the gender person was very involved. She was the driver of that policy. We actually, as a result of that policy, we actually got a program of training nurses. She got money from the Canadian government to train nurses in the management of sexual assault victims or whatever. Now, quite a few nurses were trained in dealing with that. The problem, again, is that you can't commit the provinces to keep a nurse where she or he is. So we trained this cohort of nurses to specialize in managing sexual assault patients. But in a year or two, they are transferred, removed, depending on the needs of the province at any one time. But there has been, that policy has been in place, and it's actually actualized it by getting training the people to carry on. The idea of the training was that those highly specialized nurses would train other nurses in dealing with victims of sexual assault. But as I say, attrition has been very high because of the movement of the professionals within their institutions. Male involvement in HIV and AIDS. Perhaps the best way of answering this question is, you said it yourself, Madam Chair, that HIV and AIDS in South Africa has a woman's face. And it has been very, very difficult to get men to understand that women don't transfer to each other. They don't transmit HIV to each other. It has to go via a man. And as Dr. Amos said, they are the vectors, because then they are able to go from one to the other. Now, I think it must have been in 2005 or thereabouts where there was a big and a very successful event in KZN where males, quite a number of them, hundreds of them, were actually transported by train at this fun ride. And the purpose of this, for them to be ambassadors of male involvement. And the reason we chose KZN, it was because it was said to be the most difficult area, the geographic area, the most difficult people to convince. And that was done quite successfully. In fact, that's where this Million Men March and the male involvement program started. One has to say that while at campaign level it may look successful, what actually matters is whether in practice, in daily life, the men believe what they purport to believe to when they are in a campaign situation. Our experience is that the tide is turning, but very, very slowly, very slowly. The men are happy to say, yes, we support, and we do this, and we go home, and we be ambassadors, and we promote this. But in their own personal thing, deep down, they are still the old African men. Very few of them really change genuinely. And I think it's something that we have to keep doing it all the time. But we have to accept that it's not something that will change in one generation. The one father who's converted will teach his sons, and it will be those sons that will be converted. The one father who's not converted will have to deal with the sons as well. You know, it's that kind of thing. It's a very difficult, it's a cultural thing, it's steeped in tradition and history. It's difficult. But the surprising thing is, contrary to most of our beliefs, it is not the rural, uneducated men who is difficult to change. It is our city slickers who think they know everything. So we also have to change our mindset of thinking that, no, you have to go to deep, deep Eastern Cape or deep Zululand. No, it's really the guys in Cape Town who uphold this patriarchal attitude in life. My answer is just that it's going to take long. We have to keep doing it. And I can see the numbers are increasing every time. Every time there's a conference on this and a commitment to draw, it is the main. The numbers keep growing and growing. And I remember one of the things that Dr. Amos didn't mention. At that last meeting, that last conference about this, the volunteers, the people who volunteered to do this work and come forward and help us, were more men than women who joined the committee and said, oh, this thing is a good idea. Let's do. So it's getting better with time, but we have to accept that it will not be quick. Because I don't want to leave an impression that I'm talking about black men, you'll be surprised that African-speaking men are even more conservative, far more conservative than the African men. It's impossible to penetrate them.
Well, it's because they are part of the society that doesn't even listen to the individual. Welcome, honorable member. This is honorable member from the age. I think you are here this morning, and he has to do this because there was a speaking in the NCOP. Just to brief, we have had a briefing of the background on promoting women's disability rights. From he has been using this document. This is a very good document. It's very important. Now we are just completing. I think
One other thing I would like to know is
it's just a concern that I would like to raise. What happened to this micro visa? What is the department following about the research? And I once asked the minister, seemingly it hasn't served what our expectations. Where are we now?
Thanks, ma'am. About 3 weeks ago, 3 Saturdays ago, maybe 4, we actually had a big colloquium where we called in all the researchers, local and overseas, and just to talk about this very issue. What is it? I mean, there are 3 trials have been done, both phase 2 and phase 3 trials, and none of them have been successful. And we were calling the researchers to say now, together we must decide what is the next step, because we can't keep exposing the people, the women who participate in these research to the risk, because it is a risk, because as you saw in the trials, the women actually got infected. So the conclusion of it, there was a lot of deliberation around that. But I think 2 main points came up. The first point was that it was clear that the basic science of the virus and how it behaves in a human body has not been understood. We still do not know exactly how that, because all the trials point to the opposite direction of what we were hoping, how we were hoping the virus would react. So it's clear that just the basic science we have not understood, we do not know it. So research now must stop doing research on assumption that this is what a virus does and this under these conditions and this is. We must go right back to the beginning and start to try to understand this very peculiar virus. Now, the difficulty with that is that this virus, you can't do the experiment, you can't do the research on animals. This virus doesn't grow in animals, it just grows in humans. So the dilemma we have is, if we want to overcome, to find the answer, we have to use humans. Unlike in many other things where we do research and then you can use an animal and just transpose the results to a human. Unfortunately, the human immunodeficiency virus only lives in humans, which makes it very difficult. Now, the conclusion that was reached was that, okay, phase one, we don't start any more phase one and phase two trials, because until we've answered this main question, understood exactly how the virus performs, just the basic signs of it, under what circumstances does it mutate? When does it reproduce? When does it break up? What happens? Because it's clear we missed that. It's just doing things that we didn't expect it to do. Now, we will not admit any more applications for phase 1 and phase 2 trials. So we won't have any more new people coming to join a research project. But the phase 3 trials, because we've gone that far, must be allowed to continue and finish, because at least they will give us part of the answer of what we are looking at. And besides, in any case, if there have been people that have been exposed, they've already been exposed. So we can't reverse that. So we might as well just finish the phase 3 trials, get the answers, and then decide again what is the next step. But for now, that we will not start any new trials at all.
It has been a big disappointment. All of them, all four of them have failed. The two in South Africa and Canada, all of them have failed. So in that direction, there's still no hope. The one thing that came out of the Sydney conference earlier in the year was that maybe we should not use, we should start looking at the whole an antibody mechanism, a different antibody mechanism. We shouldn't use the retroviral, the ARV-based microbicides. We should try to. So the scientists will try to formulate a chemical substance that can replace that.
I hope that as females we will have power, you know, of really controlling things. Now, it's quite a disappointment, really. We're hoping, because surprisingly, some of us never knew until we got to USA in one of these CSW conferences, that actually there was research done in Natal, yeah, and we were from South Africa, we didn't know. So that's the reason why we are following this up. Yeah.
If I can just answer to that. If I can just respond to that, it's probably more disappointing news than you would expect. It has become quite clear to us that there's a lot of research that goes on in this country secretly. Two years ago in Toronto, I walked into one of the seminars. There were two presentations from South African researchers. Well, they may not have been South African, but the research was done in South Africa. A presentation on South African research that was not documented anywhere in our documents, had never gone through the application. So there is a lot of research that goes on secretly. Part of the reason, of course, is mischief, knowing that we will not pass that kind of research, allow that kind of research to go on. But the other part also is that researchers are very competitive people, extremely competitive, secretive. So the reason they would keep it quiet is just to be a step ahead of their competitors. So that suddenly there's a conference and bah, there's this big find. You know, that's how they operate. The third reason is that there's a lot of money in research. It's an amazing amount of money. Research is extremely expensive, so it pays well for those who do it. And that also has a perverse incentive that people will do some nonsense research only because they want to access money. So it is not because of our carelessness or anything. We've got very, very good research approval systems from the ethics councils, from the ethics committees, to the overall scientific committee, to the council, to the department, backwards and forwards. So we do control very, very stringently. But there's a lot that just goes on under the table for the reasons that I have. As I say, you're not the only one. I've been, but at least you could say, I'm a parliamentarian, I wouldn't know this. I couldn't say that. I'm in a position where I should know about the research, but I didn't know. Worse still, it was research conducted mainly by people from outside, which means they've got a lot of help from inside the country to keep it clandestine and do it.
Alright, thank you. Would anyone like to give advice? So far? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. It's not advice because I just don't want to delay the meeting because I wasn't here when the presentation was done. but also to apologize that we tried to get out of the chamber, but we couldn't. Just a request to the chief director. If I look at this document, there are a lot of acronyms. It may be because if I read that this document alone, I won't understand what, you know, SRA, MCWA are standing for. So, so for a person who was in the meeting, trying to get information, it's going to be really very difficult.
No, thanks very much, ma'am. We will correct that. We have tried. I thought we had tried. Actually, I went through this last night, and I thought I'd actually changed. We had tried. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, you have the document that we sent earlier, 2 days ago. Oh, yes, yeah, we do apologize. That one doesn't have. Oh, we did revise the document after we sent it, and that's when I noticed that now we had gone with all these acronyms. In the latest document, which we will have access to,
right.
Every one of them is explained.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you, Dave. I don't know whether. All right. Oh, by the way, you said you wanted to be present. I'm sorry, you will go on.
Thank you, Chief. I just want to know. The concern around the increase in terminations and the decline in contraceptive use,
mm-hmm.
is there a specific age group that's making use of, or that's demanding, that's more in demand for termination? Because if it's younger women or whether it's old women, it will be interesting to know whether it's younger women opting for terminations instead of using family planning because it's now more freely available. Within the service. And then secondly, in terms of young women, accessibility of services to young women. I know that there are services available, youth-friendly services, but there's still a very high amount of teenage pregnancies. So in terms of services in your smaller areas, you often find that young women are afraid to go to the clinic because it's a small area and you know the nurse, your mother knows the nurse, your grandmother knows the nurse is providing the services, so you still find those kinds of problems in your smaller areas. What is being done for young women in those areas?
Yes, certainly. One has to say it's younger women, very disturbingly so, age 15 to 19. That has a high, let me say age 15 to 24, because usually it's 15 to 19, 19 to 24, mm. but that group is the one where we find an increase in terminations. Now, we have, in the latest DHS survey, our survey on health, our health survey, we've asked that question because we're worried, why are they substituting contraception with termination of pregnancy? Mm-hmm. And that will answer your second question also. Access is no longer such a major problem. So why are they, access of contraception mm-hmm. is no longer such a major problem? Why is it that teenagers get pregnant when they can access contraception? And in fact, it's much more complicated to access termination than. But what we have found is that, no, a lot of them, in the survey shows that they get pregnant on the spur of the moment. You know, it's like they've gone to a party and met this guy and he took them home, you know. So that's what happens. So it's not because access is difficult at the clinic, in the local clinic. No, it's just because that day. And it's something that disturbs us because it is saying to us, we are trying to say to all teenagers, keep a condom with you, especially if you're going to a party or if, you know. But it somehow there's this confidence that, no, I won't need it. You know, I don't have a boyfriend and I don't like those guys. But once after the party, all that is forgotten. You know, so it's certainly not because of access. It's not because there's difficulty in access. It's attitude to life, attitude to you know, it's just the attitude of risk. our children's attitude towards risk is very negative. And that is what is causing that problem. Dr. Amos wants to add a few things now. Yes.
Thank you. Not quite. In fact, it was just to add to one of the things that we're beginning to see. I'm sure you are aware that we do provide the post exposure prophylaxis to HIV and AIDS. And if you can look at the trend, then this program is not necessarily because it's provided in hospitals. However, during periods of, you know, festivals like Easter, when holidays, Christmas, and there is a great demand for post exposure prophylaxis. So you realize that this is this matter of thing. Go to parties and then they say, I'm sorry, the condom broke and whatever else. The issues is around this time. And why is that we have so many accidents during this time? Mm-hmm. So as she says, it is what I initially spoke to, similar to address sex. Very complicated concept. And this is why. Why would people continue being infected? Well, one of the questions that our chairperson had asked was, you know, it doesn't look like there's lots of understanding of HIV and AIDS amongst the male folk. Truth is, again, it's got to do with the thing. It's got nothing to do with lack of information. Knowledge, information does not necessarily translate to behavior. People have to make decisions. And this is one area that we cannot reach. It's about individual choices again. It's not because people don't know. Maybe. That's about all. I don't know. In some instances, I thought maybe we should not necessarily belabor the point, because this mother had honestly responded very well to some of the problems, but the questions that were raised. I was going to say, much as he did indicate the involvement of, you know, our very senior people in terms of, you know, sexual positive health and our programs and religion in particular, to say, at a lower level again, there is, you know, an awareness. We've been having meetings with representatives from the Council of Health through the assistance of WHO and Population and Development Council. And I'm saying, I see us beginning to break the barriers. Important, like in some instances, is honestly misinformation or lack of true understanding. Once you start sitting down with these ministers of religion and you explain to them exactly what is happening, their barriers begin to fall off. So I think again there, you know, we have already made very few inroads. And I guess the other thing I still feel that there wouldn't be a need to maybe to add. One other thing, Tetena, I'm going to request that please, is that document where it is a hysterectomy, that should be erased. It's not meant to be hysterectomy. Everybody else just in case they missed it, I think it was a very, you know, big error. And again, to try and explain why, you know, this sterilization where it was asked whether it's mandatory or whether it was voluntary. It is voluntary. However, again, for pathological reasons or for morbidity and mortality, we do encourage grand multiparous women, that is, you know, elderly women from 40, 45 to undergo, you know, because it is very difficult to see people should not engage in sex. But then some people just relax because they are that age to say, if you are married, because even many children, especially at shorter intervals and being elderly, that impacts on your health. So those are the reasons why we would encourage
women beyond 35 and so to consider their only options given.
Madam Chair, I retract Dr. Amos' statement of saying a 40-year-old woman is elder.
Oh,
okay. She's slightly ahead.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Really, mina ngine problem. I just want to ask each department, is any program to bring back a culture of family planning to Bantwana Bethu? Because it's out of fashion. It's really out of fashion. Let me make exemplar. She was born 1970. Mangala ubona ukuthi ngathi now she's sexually active. I said to her, there's a family planning just next door where I'm staying at Snawani. They won't ask you my reference book. They won't ask you a permit or what. You know? So they were telling Uchi for the family planning. Because it was out of fashion in the family planning, as the cooler, as I might discuss it, in the family planning, being listened to his name, if we are with family planning, if you are sleeping with your boyfriend, or you know, you're tasteless, so many things, it is discussed as a man to man. To understand, Gucci, that age group, yeah, Bobonke, my bad, Tolabantuan, to prove Gucci, the family planning is out of fashion. Tinamas Kulamina, I started to know about the family planning in 1972. I make it a point, Gucci, Umtana minor 10 days, I run to the family planning because being my ass. You know? But 1972, I started to know about the family planning. My figure was 8 years ago. The family planning was out of fashion. You know? They started to say they are confused. We are talking about family planning, we are talking about condoms, you know? All these things, you know? That's why Sibona a high rate of pregnancy, teenage pregnancy in that. I circle in the family planning. In front of the department, are you visiting those old family planning in our township? What's really happening? Lavandala Mamanto Mazana, Bayeza, a family planning. Maybe each department in an awareness, you know, or a program to make sure Lavandala Bayago family planning. In the end, I told an interview about the Lamamanto Mazana. But it's not user friendly, family planning. Immediately, again, I was family planning. I'm an infertile, who plan on the family, you know? It was not user friendly. Maybe I'm a problem, I'm a nurse. I think you go over corner, e problem, Nabu TV, AIN, Nabu Team, because you're from a camera, why you're family planning. What all of it is not user friendly, family planning. Any into a cause a young and dolly. But Konamanje, but substitute in the family planning, meaning a termination of pregnancy, you know? And Abakabanguti is risky Abaitatayu in Garana. It's not only about pregnancy, Gunendo HIV AIDS, you know? One of the Bakabanguti in pregnancy, Gunum Dari neighbor, I'm saying we had 3 times, you know, the school is 3 times. You know, at risk to be HIV positive, I equal to now, just in the year, and terminate pregnant. You know, maybe if the department can go back and visit those old family planning clinics as gone, they check a routine, but in Lavandwana, Gulokos, you know, go family planning, because really must come up in a program. Nento ye pap smear. Once had a program, we have mentors on my health day, you know, seeing our placards around clinics, Gucci, I'm the father and the I'm a father and I understand. Minaga the pap smear, I understand. The man told him done, Gucci wins a pap smear. Finchet letter, I'll explain to him why wins that pap smear that time, you know. Kagaganani, Kupo Mama, Kumaraba, everyone, Gucci, have you got a campaign? And a tatwa does a pap smear into the Lantana, which they must go back to where the show would
bayabona ukuthi ababe pregnant because really uthole isikole esi one labantwana abayi more than 100 aba pregnant bamantombazana. Yourself that question ukuthi yini i problem esibhekene nayo abayifune nokuyazi abantwana bethu bamantombazana into esebeliqinile. Really ngenzi exemplary ngumntana wentombazana. Thole friend kube pregnant like mhlawumbe loba pregnant again. You know? Azange akayuse, azange ngiyilayini ngini ngikhuluma naye. You know, kulalethe ukuthi there's no communication with my parents nabantwana bethu bamantombazana. But mina ngangisendlini ngikhuluma naye. You know? Ngize ngilamulelwe yini kuthi waba nama-fibros wakwazi ukuthi ayokwenza ilokho in stereotop. Phe, ngaphandle kwalokho angikhumbule because of family planning. Thank you.
Thank you. Before you, I must as well just hold the question. We nearly forgot,
and it's our interest, you know, because we have been trying to ask. I'm just reminded by our researcher about the female genital mutilation. Have you managed maybe to intervene, to educate people how dangerous this is in relation to reproductive health?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think you've brought the most difficult questions ever. So I'm actually here to present. These are the most challenging. Mama Kumalo, I don't know. You know, this is a vexing question. And because actually what you are saying to us is that there's just no public health education going on in communities. Because if there was, family planning would have been one of those things. Mm-hmm. However, though, without, I'm not even trying to defend the department because I'm also aware of things that have just petered out. Mm-hmm. I think the mistake that we have made is in our panic around transmission of HIV and promoting the use of condoms. Because we believe that the condoms will prevent the pregnancy and will prevent the transmission. We completely maybe underplayed the use of family planning the way it was. It has been traditional to have family planning. And I will ask Dr. Amos, because there are programs in place family planning programs, and I think the question prompted. I did say it's disturbing us to see that the age group 15 to 24 seem to be thinking that termination of pregnancy is a replacement for contraception. We've tried to explain that it cannot be. To terminate a pregnancy must be something exceptional under special circumstances for some very good reason. It shouldn't be interpreted as willy-nilly. You can get pregnant today and terminate it tomorrow. Get pregnant today and terminate it tomorrow. That's number one. Number two is, I mean, it's quite heartening. It's quite encouraging that at least you are able to talk to your daughter. You must be 1 in 100 mothers. Because there's a major problem. The lack of communication, open communication between mothers and daughters at that level, and among the society itself. We have found one thing that is stuck in our society, that even when you provide these youth-friendly what, many of the kids there go secretly. Why? Because Abu Mama were never involved in this. And we're thinking our next thrust is when we do these things, we don't invite the kids alone. We invite the kids and the parents. So
children don't have to lie and say, hey, Tagela Sbule, you know? Because the slip comes in when every time she has now to steal away from home and go and get her family planning things or talk to other teenagers. But that's a major thing. So you are quite right. I mean, just something has gone horribly wrong, and we feel maybe it is to do with the fact that, you know, when AIDS was coming on us like an avalanche, we grabbed the easiest thing, which was a condom, and in that probably undermined the use of traditional family planning and the talking and the going on. It is very true also that even where those are services, that our own survey has shown us that our professionals are very unfriendly to the kids. I mean, they're unfriendly to everybody. Worse to children, to girls who walk in. And that is, in fact, what prompted the starting of these youth-friendly centers. Because we just thought, now, you know, we try to change the attitudes of the nurses. So... But anyway, maybe I should give Dr. Amos a chance. Female genital mutilation, that's one of Africa's major, major problems. However, the southern part of Africa doesn't seem to engage, because it's actually a traditional practice of the Nilotic peoples. It's a practice that's done by that group of people, which are found all over Africa, except down, where we are. We have not found FGM as a major problem in the southern part of Africa. If people do it, it would be the people who come from where it's done and it's part of their tradition. But in general, we don't have a major problem. We don't have a problem. I'm not aware of a Southern African tribe or people that does that as a tradition. I'm not aware of any. However, as I say, it's a major problem in Africa, a serious, serious public health problem in Africa. And I know that WHO is addressing that quite aggressively. The First Lady of Egypt has been designated as the ambassador, because it's done mostly, as I say, by all Nilotic people, the Arabs, the East Africans, those are the people who do female genital mutilation as part of their culture. So maybe I can't talk more on that one. It's not a public health problem in the south of Africa. It is a major public health problem for the rest of Africa, and it's being addressed, I think, quite significantly by competent bodies. Dr. Amos, you wanted to add something to do with this family planning program. Mama Kumalo has pointed out the lack of such services.
Thank you. Maybe I can go a little back to this family genital mutilation that Mrs. Matawa has clearly indicated that it is not a problem in South Africa, as far as we know. What we have in South Africa is the so-called female genital manipulation, where the ladies, you know, from a young age, pull their labia minor. And that, again, is supposed to be to enhance sexual pleasure. But this is not violent or necessarily a violation, although it is a cultural issue. Now, with regards to family planning, the reason perhaps why our family planning is where it is today are multifactorial. You will remember the stringent days of family planning, as you are indicating. That was during the, you know, the past government. And at the time, you know, every resource was almost put on family planning. And the reason was that, you know, there was a need to reduce the number of children who, you know, the black children. And with, you know, a progress and as time was moving on, there was a feeling that, you know what, we are going to, our strength is in our numbers. And therefore it was like, you know, family planning to sort of like a vaccine. We have, however, realized the gap, fortunately. And like I was saying, when you look at our statistics, we say we've got a family planning coverage of 65%. However, with the these observations of an increase in teenage pregnancy and those kinds of things. And what we have done, as Ms. Mata was saying, the communication strategy has been focusing specifically on HIV and AIDS. We've got a very strong communication strategy, the commonality strategy, that is the brand that is known by all of us. What we are doing now at National Department of Health, and to even get messages on sexual and reproductive health to be a part of this commonality. And again, the response has been made with regard to the user-friendly issue that if you look at our presentation here, we have made mention of our expansion of our user-friendly services, that we train the nurses, we sensitize the family, youth-friendly nurses to really address the issues of children, accrediting facilities that are user-friendly, where we know that people are going to adhere to that. What we need to do is to intensify our monitoring to see that happens. And then, yes, that's why we did raise in our presentation a concern of termination of pregnancy seems to be rearing a very ugly head, which was not what we had intended. But with regards to family planning, we are working now closely with the Department of Education, because you know when you go to some schools to try and promote their program, there is this fear, you know, there's still this denial that what are you suggesting? Are you saying our children are sexually active? You know, I said sex is a problem. We view it differently. When you think I am going to be talking freely about with it, if you don't know whether you are enabling or you are disabling the use of those kinds of things. But I need to say, I'd like to challenge parents. Their parents are so fearful of discussing sex with their children. Very fierce, Mrs. Mata was saying, do those kinds of things. And I used to be in practice some time back and to say that family planning is really out of fashion. There were people who would come to me complaining about infertility. When you say, what do you mean, you have a husband? No, I don't have a husband. Why? No, everybody in our street has got a child, and people think I am barren because I don't have children. So again, it is the education. And I think if parents don't play a part and they keep thinking it is somebody else's business, we're not going to go far. And to say then, campaigns again, maybe we're not as vocal as we're supposed to be. However, to say we honestly are now going out of our way to really raise awareness. And now we're no longer even looking at this, you know, this one-day campaign, where we make noise and there's no sustainability. We're moving away from there. We're trying to use one of the programs, the IMCI, that is the household and community component of management of childhood, to look at all the programs. And we do house-to-house visits, because this one-day or one-weekend thing is not working. And to say that has helped us, we have been able to increase the coverage of cervical cancer screening from a stagnant 1.6% over 6 years to about 30% coverage within 1 year, and that was last year. And we are hoping to intensify that. And again, we also do from time to time get invited by the moral regeneration groups, and this is where, again, we are facing, you know, social development, even the school, so that we need to make use of all government departments that have got anything to do with children, you know. And we are hoping that we are not necessarily going to see the outcomes or the results immediately, but with time, this seed that is implanted is going to generate and turn into something else. I don't know if there's anything that I've left behind.
Thank you, Derek. You know, I want to, I'm just thinking here, when we spoke about the budget constraint, that you feel that as national, really, the budget, it hasn't got a serious problem. Now, I'm thinking whether what I'm going to ask is because it's a provincial competence. because I find it very strange to find that in the hospitals, I come from Gauteng, you will find that, I'm not going to mention the name, but, one of the hospitals I was surprised about, their treatment, and it was, when I spoke to the leadership there, the superintendent, actually I was in a company of one of the MPs, my friend Meg. They really tried to explain to us that the budget that they have, and vis-a-vis the rate of HIV, you know, it's something that is difficult for them to address. The way they are, they find it difficult, and you go to their sleuth room, you find that actually there's nothing that you can utilize for people who are affected now. Not only HIV, who are AIDS victims. You know what I'm talking about. Yeah. We have reached that level. We spoke to them, and you know, they defeated us when they said the budget, because this implies that as government we are doing nothing. I wanted to ask about this budget problem, the constraints, because I know what do we get in hospitals, because I stay in Soweto, I don't stay in any other place, and I think in Soweto we've got good experience. That's why Mundu is talking about such things.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Yes, as you're quite right that unfortunately there's a delineation in the budget. The national department generally has nothing to do with provincial budgets. The treasury allocates the provinces their budget through their provincial treasury. And it is the provincial treasuries that decide how much each department is going to get. Now, sitting in the National Treasury, a National Treasury Committee that deals with their budget allocation, the division of budgets and all that and all that. I also want to mention the province or the provinces, but generally they apply to all provinces, that there is a complaint generally from every province about budget. But it is also true that every year there is unspent funds. So maybe that is the area which we should look at. Why is it that there are unspent funds and yet there is under budgeting? Now, this is what I think happens, and I'm not sure that this could be true or not. What I think happens is the Treasury allocates to all the departments that it's supposed to. Some departments are overstretched, the budget is overstretched, others is underspent. But then the provinces themselves fail to have a mechanism where they can then transfer the funds to those. There's nothing in law that allows that kind of thing, because that would make it easy. If transport is underspending and health needs money, it would help to have a mechanism where the Treasury can allow direct, but there's nothing in law that allows that kind of thing. If you have not spent your budget, then it goes back to Treasury. And if the other guy is short, tough, I think that's what happens. So it's probably something for government to look at, the parliamentarians to motivate, yes, to motivate. Because it is true that a lot of health facilities are under-resourced.
terribly under-resourced. They are struggling with human resources. They're struggling with the budget. They are overspending. So it would help to have a mechanism of transfer, internal transfer, or something like that.
Thank you. You know, I've been listening to what the sister director said.
Oh, Sibulele. I think we also have a responsibility as parliamentarians because of the role that we have to play in the society, the oversight role. Maybe the other thing that would assist is for us to be interacting with the department, to invite them to our constituencies, you know, to give this explanation if we think that the information is not disseminated properly. I think we should start thinking of other, you know, adventures. Because it's all about South African government and improving the lives of people. I also think we have a big responsibility. That's what I wanted to say, because I can hear there is lack of maybe discussing. We have a symposium where everyone can speak out. Mm-hmm. We can have a symposium of getting not necessarily political structures, getting everyone to come in at them. Yeah. I think we are getting to the end now.
That would really appreciate that kind of, you know, a joint confrontation of, particularly because I think at national level, it's not easy for us to just, you know, to go to the communities. We have to get permission from the provincial department. Sometimes they are not available, and therefore we can't come if they are not there. You know, that kind of thing. It would be nice just to have somebody like the parliamentary group, then invite all of us, and we can sit. And then I think it would be very useful. Mm-hmm. Would really appreciate that.
I think we're done with now. No one would like to. Now it's my turn to thank everyone. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mom.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.